Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Allocation of Resources. Our presenter is Jan Chalupny, session number CHJA 2006-5. Let's listen in.
Okay, well, I guess we'll get started. I'm Jan Chalupny. I'm a molecular biologist, and I work for a biotech biopharmaceutical company called Amgen. So, those are my credentials. I've been teaching this kind of human genome, genetics, biotech, ethics kind of discussion groups at churches in the Seattle area for a while. And in that situation, I usually only have 2 hours to do everything, so I let people choose what topics they want to most discuss. It's usually stem cells and cloning. And so I'm excited to be at Holden, where I have 5 one-hour sessions and I can actually talk about allocation of resources, which is sort of the topic for tonight's discussion. How do we allocate both local healthcare, medical treatment kind of resources locally and then globally? What's the best way to allocate those resources? So these kind of discussion topics are the most difficult for me too, because as a molecular biologist employed by a biotech company, right, this calls into question my where I have my employment, and makes me wonder, you know, would I be better employed in a public health capacity rather than in a research capacity for a corporation. So those are just personal issues of my own that I have to sort of think about when I lead a discussion about topics such as this. So personalized medicine is a topic that's been in the news lately due to all the advances in biotechnology and the fact that the human genome, that is all the DNA that makes humans human, has been sequenced. Are you familiar with that term? Have you heard it? So personalized medicine is medicine that's really tailored to the individual person. So especially in cancer care, that's something that is looked at as a huge advance. Just quoting from an article in the Los Angeles Times. Right now, people get a one-size-fits-all treatment for cancer, and a few other things get factored into treatment, says Dr. Patricia, pathologist at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. At issue is the fact that even when two cancers from different patients appear identical, they may act differently and respond differently to the same drugs, presumably because of the internal mistakes, that is, misspellings in genes, that have caused the cells to turn rogue and become cancerous are not the same. And so scientists are seeking distinct genetic signatures, combinations of genes that are inappropriately active or inactive in cancer tissues. So personalized medicine would be, if you come down with breast cancer or pancreatic cancer, you go in and see your oncologist, and instead of saying, well, here's the best treatment that we have for this type of cancer, they would take a biopsy from you, they would take those cells, and they would isolate the DNA from those cells, and they would run it, they would do something that's called array technology, where they would run that DNA over a tiny silicone or glass chip that has various DNAs laid down in tiny, tiny dots, and if a gene is upregulated or downregulated, you see a difference in how well the DNA from the patient's cells would hybridize to the corresponding DNA. Because DNA is it's a two-chain molecule, and so each chain is a mirror image of the other. So if you get a lot of binding, then that's an upregulated gene. That's something that's being expressed a lot. And if you get less binding, then that's something that's being downregulated or not expressed at all. And so they can have a chip that has the different genes that they have discovered are involved in this kind of cancer, are either upregulated or downregulated, and they can screen an individual patient's DNA of their cancer cells and try and figure out what kind of profile they have. if they have enough information on different profiles and how they respond to different drugs, instead of treating you with drug X, which is the most popular anti-pancreatic cancer drug, they might look at your profile and say, well, the people that don't respond to this drug X have the same profile, but they seem to respond better to drug Y, so then they would give you drug Y. And presumably that could save time for the patient being treated with something that's not going to work, versus trying to choose the best treatment for the individual patient. So that's what personalized medicine is. It's very technological in nature, very high tech. And so there's a cost associated with that. It's not going to be cheap, especially to begin with. If more and more people start doing it, you know, technology always gets kind of streamlined, and if it's used a lot, it usually becomes cheaper. But it's certainly not going to be, there will be a cost to it, it's not going to be super cheap. So access to healthcare, then, it's already an issue, right, in our society. As drugs become more and more high-tech in nature, or the way in which they are discovered and produced, costs go up and access to healthcare becomes an even bigger question. Who has access to healthcare? Who doesn't? I think it's pretty clear locally in our own society that access to healthcare is based largely upon your financial wealth. Do you have money to pay for it, or are you employed by an employer that provides healthcare? So it tends to sort out along economic lines. People with the least economically tend to work in jobs where healthcare may not be provided, or if it is, it's at a lesser level, and they can't come up with the out-of-pocket expenses for really expensive treatments. So if we have this wonderful personalized medicine that can treat each patient as an individual and kind of tailor-make a treatment for them, what about the people that can't afford that? You know, is that the best use of healthcare resources? I don't know if people have questions or opinions.
Yeah, a question. Does it matter if a hospital is a for-profit hospital or community-owned? Do you know anything about that? I just came from that experience, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, that's not my area of expertise at all, so I don't know the answer to that question, whether there's a difference there. There may be a difference. A for-profit hospital could have more access to, if they make a profit, to money to buy the technology that's necessary to do the personalized medicine. That technology costs a fair amount of money.
At this point in time, where do the insurance companies stand? Are they tending to go along with the cost associated with these?
Well, personalized medicine is really new and is not really being used yet. So it remains to be seen what insurance companies tend to shy away from anything that they deem experimental. So at least in the early stages, that may be the case. I mean, it took bone marrow transplant went on for a long time before it was deemed non-experimental and healthcare insurance providers would pay for that. So I'm not sure, but I would guess that in the beginning it might be deemed experimental and thereby not covered, or not covered to a very high extent, which then makes the discrepancy about who can get it and who can't even greater. If you have to pay out-of-pocket expenses for that kind of thing, you have to have a lot of extra cash lying around to be able to do that. So, you know, there are other ways that diseases like cancer can be addressed, and prevention versus treatment, that's a big question. Would it be a better use of our healthcare dollars to really put a big push into prevention? Here's another, this is from the Wall Street Journal, stating that lifestyle changes could prevent almost half of cancer deaths. As many as half of cancer deaths could be prevented if more people made lifestyle changes, such as avoiding smoking and excessive sun exposure, eating nutritiously and getting regular exercise, and recommended health screenings. And there's a case in which there's a discrepancy between rich and poor, right? You can't pay for regular health screenings if you don't have good insurance or a lot of extra money, according to a study from the American Cancer Society. Whether due to socioeconomic or personal challenges, many people have trouble following common health precautions, said Vilma Lupinides, who has co-authored a report on risk factor surveillance for the American Cancer Society in Atlanta. What's astonishing is how small the numbers are in terms of the population actually doing these things. It's a disconnect. The awareness that theoretically half of cancer deaths could be prevented hasn't gotten in the mindset. Smoking is the biggest sticking point because it increases the risk of many kinds of cancer, not just lung cancer, and is expected to kill 170,000 people this year. About a third of the 564,830, I don't know how they arrived at that number exactly, expected cancer deaths in 2006 will be related to poor diets, physical inactivity, and obesity, which itself causes many chronic illnesses, the report said. Americans have been receiving the anti-tobacco message for decades, but one in five adults still lights up. Despite calls for better nutrition and more physical activity to maintain a healthy weight, waistlines are growing dangerously wider. And few people do enough to protect their skin from the sun's harmful rays, leading to high rates of skin cancer. So, clearly, we should know what we should do, but oftentimes we still choose not to do it as far as not getting enough exercise or not really watching our diet. And the same is true in the case of diabetes. Diabetes is growing at an astronomical rate, type 2 diabetes in our population, in adults and in children, where it was hardly ever seen earlier. And that has been linked directly to inactivity and diet. We eat more processed foods and we get much less exercise, kids included. Kids spend a lot of time sitting in front of electronic devices and not as much time as they used to outside playing sports or just with their friends outside. So there's another place where you wonder, should we put more money into trying to change people's habits versus trying to cure them once they already have a disease that could have been prevented in the first place? And you can't always prevent cancer or diabetes. Some people have a genetic predisposition. But if you can prevent half, that would be a huge savings of healthcare dollars. And there's also, again, there's a link, an economic link, in that if you look over populations in which individuals in the population are having, you know, greater increase in diabetes and less likely to do anything about lifestyle changes, it's often it often tracks with lower income. And you could imagine that people with lower income have much more stress, probably, because they're worried about paying bills. They may be working two jobs. Finding the time to fit exercise into their life may not be their first priority, nor perhaps is going to the grocery store and buying healthy foods and preparing them at home versus stopping by McDonald's for a Big Mac. That's a lot faster, but it's a lot less nutritious. And there have also been a number of reports that while diabetes is a growing problem in the U.S. where we're fairly affluent, that 7 of the 10 countries with the highest number of diabetics are in the developing world. And then in those nations, it's even more of a problem than here. I mean, diabetes causes some really severe health problems, blindness, problems with circulation, and if it's not treated, it results in death. So I'm quoting here from a New York Times article. In some of the world's poorest nations, and this is referring to diabetes, the disease is a quick death sentence. While Americans can live for many years with the disease, a person in Mozambique, for instance, who requires injections of insulin can expect to live just a year. In Mali, such people survive about 30 months. There are many factors driving the growth in diabetes worldwide, but most experts agree that changes in lifestyle and diet are the chief culprits, in addition to genetic predisposition. As developing countries rapidly industrialize, people tend to do work involving less physical activity. At the same time, the availability of food that is cheap but high in calories becomes more common. The combination causes weight gain, which leads to a greater risk of developing type 2 diabetes, the most common form of the disease. And then they quote the president-elect of the International Diabetes Federation, who says, the diabetes epidemic will overwhelm healthcare resources everywhere if governments do not wake up now and take action.
Sometimes the diet change as they develop so that there is more sugar content or starch?
More processed food,
okay.
You know, fast food. Corporations have moved into the developing world. You know, anywhere you go, there's McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken and just white bread, you know, lemon bread. I'm not trying to target these companies specifically over any other companies, they're just examples. Just the refined foods, yeah, that are quick to pick up off the shelf and eat. You know, cookies in a box made in a factory somewhere, crackers, things with really refined flour.
I never thought that sushi or some of those things that have been more indigenous would be that healthy either, but maybe that's...
Well, the Asian population has a much lower incidence of many types of cancer and diabetes, although with the advent of more processed foods, that's changing.
And I also know that in developing countries, Coca-Cola is much more, you know, prevalent than water, you know.
Right, and soda is, right, it fills you up, but it gives you no health benefit, no nutritional benefit whatsoever. So it fills you up with a lot of sugar, but you don't get any health benefit from that. I was just reading a nutrition newsletter that we get at our house, just saying, if you just got rid of soda pop, that would be a huge improvement in people's diets, if they would just drink water instead of soda, because soda has so much sugar in it.
They were taking that at least of our schools.
Yeah, right, that's been a...
I moved to that.
Yeah, that's been a problem in schools. There have been a lot of vending machines, and kids can buy a lot of this kind of stuff. So, there are a lot of things that could be done, but how do you get people to change their lifestyle? You know, that seems to be a difficult thing to do. There have been a lot of campaigns against smoking, especially aimed at young people. And sometimes those seem to be working and the numbers seem to be dropping, but then the numbers will begin to rise again.
Yeah, I think just the other day, like 2 days ago, I heard it went from 24% to 21%. That's not a big jump. I mean, that's a so very...
In what?
In smoking. In people who stop,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
Those are the people who... say it's still 1 in 5.
So, now that's... That's a difficult. How do you get people to eat more nutritiously? And I guess you can put pressure on purveyors of processed food, and that's something that we all could do too. I mean, McDonald's sells salads now, and I think in some cases that's a result of people demanding more. And also, I don't know if you've seen the movie Super Size Me. McDonald's got major bad publicity from that movie, where Morgan Spurlock ate nothing but McDonald's for a month, I think, and there were huge changes in his blood chemistry and his health. It worked really well on my kids, I have to say. not all of that movie is age appropriate for my children, but we showed them certain bits of it. They don't ask to go to McDonald's as often, or fast food in general.
But isn't something like a hamburger helper or some of the something like that equally as bad because they have a lot of just refined foods and additives?
A lot of pastas and things like that are made with refined flour. I mean, it does take effort to shop for things that don't. That's something that I'm still struggling with too. If you're working and you've got kids, and the Safeway's right on your way home, nothing against Safeway, but again, you can get more healthy stuff at Safeway than you used to be able to. But and then the stuff's just right on the shelf and easy to fix. Versus going to the trying to buy fresh things from local producers and going to the farmers market or the co-op.
Well, it takes 15 minutes to do brown rice, you know, and 10 minutes to do the other.
So, you know, I guess
it's really planned.
Things that that we all could work on.
It's one of the things I think about, not just about food, but other kind of life conveniences that in my becoming a parent and looking back at my childhood, is that the balance between time and money and what we feel we have available has shifted drastically towards having money available and not having time. And that's one of the things I wondered about with the increase in oil costs and things like that. Like, I'm from it's really cold, and people used to be heating their houses with heating oil. But if that gets prohibitive, there's everybody putting in wood stoves and that sort of thing. So I imagine that there are people with wood lots, and so the balance might shift back to having time, needing, not having the money for the oil, but needing to have time to chop 3/4 wood or 8/4 wood for heating. And I wonder if that's true for food costs as well. That people might find the time to bake bread, fresh bread, and it would not only save money perhaps, but obviously have health benefits that we took for granted 40 years ago.
Right, yeah, how do we plan our time?
Yeah.
We're busy and working a lot. There have also been a number of articles about how that healthcare spending is likely to outpace our economy's growth, as the cost of all these treatments, you know, is quite large. And so, you know, what do we do about that? How do we make a healthcare budget that provides more equally for all? There are trade-offs, you know, then maybe some of the personalized medicine is not going to be covered by insurance to try to make sort of federal healthcare dollars stretch farther, Medicare, Medicaid. But then again, that just makes the inequity even more so socioeconomically, so then only the very, very rich can afford those kind of treatments. Now, what do we do about that as a society? There aren't any easy answers.
If the society can't figure it out, and they won't for a long time, what can we do individually in our families and besides not going to McDonald's?
Well, we'll get to that a bit at the end. Okay. Like, what is health? What is the church community's role? First, I'd like to just delve into public health a little bit more. I mean, we've talked about it on sort of a local level in our own nation and communities, but what about global health? What about people all over the world who can't even dream about personalized medicine, have no access to healthcare whatsoever, who would survive much better if they only had clean water or better nutrition or decent sanitation? This is a map. I can make copies of it because it's in color and that would be expensive. But this is a map of the probability of dying per 1,000 people. The probability of dying under 5 years of age, this is for males, not females, but they're probably somewhat comparable. It's from the World Health Organization for 2003, so I pulled this up off the internet. And the probability, it's very high. Blue is low, dark, dark blue is the lowest. So here we are in the US, Canada. Now the probability of dying under 5 years of age is really low for us. But, you know, yellow, orange, red is quite high. And you can see in Africa and some areas of Asia, and then into the green in some parts of South America, you have a far higher probability of dying under the age of 5. And so, you know, that's a major inequity right there, that kids just don't survive nearly as well in a lot of developing nations.
And so immunization is part of that too?
Immunization would be part of that as well, sure, if you don't have any access to healthcare, smallpox, not smallpox anymore, but other types of diseases that one, measles that one could be inoculated against, you're not going to be getting those.
And there's just a pattern, right? If you, if the children don't die so young, people have fewer children?
That tends to be a pattern in some areas, that well, the more affluent countries tend to have fewer children than less affluent countries. But that's also probably related to healthcare as well. Neonatal care, access to birth control, for instance. Yeah. Another thing from the WHO that I pulled up that deals with nutrition says poor nutrition contributes to one out of two deaths, so 50% approximately, associated with infectious diseases among children aged under 5 in developing countries. So that has to do, not only would they not get any immunizations, but if you're malnourished, your body can't fight. We have immune systems, you know, that can fight off a number of things, but if you have poor nutrition, you're not going to be able to fight off bacteria or virus or whatever it is that's making you sick. And undernutrition among pregnant women in developing countries leads to 1 out of 6 infants born with low birth weight, so they're behind the eight ball, so right from the beginning. This is not only a risk factor for neonatal deaths, but also causes learning disabilities, mental retardation, poor health, blindness, and premature death. More people in developing countries are affected by vitamin and mineral deficiencies, so just a multivitamin every day, like we take for granted for ourselves and our kids, would be helpful. Zinc deficiencies, and then HIV/AIDS is a huge problem in developing countries, especially Africa. So it's just decimating populations there. How do we respond to that? How do we try to get life-saving medications to people there? On the subject of water, sanitation, and hygiene, this is from the Red Cross. More than 1 billion people do not have access to clean water. That's a lot of people, 1 billion. Over 2 billion people do not have adequate sanitation facilities. Some 4 million people die each year from diseases associated with the lack of access to safe drinking water, inadequate sanitation, and poor hygiene. And some waterborne diseases, diarrhea can kill you easily. Cholera, dysentery, typhoid, guinea worm, hepatitis, and things like malaria and West Nile virus that are carried by mosquitoes, which breed in stagnant water. So there are a lot of things.
Do you have anything on the statistics for just some of these incredibly large refugee camps in Africa because of the fighting going on there?
Yeah, no, I don't have any statistics there.
But wouldn't that be a place where you would just be?
A lot of people in close proximity to each other, not enough sanitation. Sure, you would imagine if diseases could spread quickly in cases like that. So what's our role as individuals and as people of faith? I mean, these are huge problems, they're almost overwhelming, difficult to grasp and difficult to think about what you can do about it. Either individually or even as a church community, or for instance, the ELCA, right? The Lutheran Church does a lot of work in the developing world in all of these areas. How best can we contribute to that? I have a caring for our health, our shared endeavor. This is a social statement from the ELCA. And there are just a few lines that I wanted to quote from here. Rising healthcare costs leave a growing number of people without adequate healthcare. Healthcare resources are often rationed based on ability to pay rather than needs. So that's sort of what we've already been talking about. Another issue is, what is health? I mean, when we think of healthcare, we basically think of the medical community, right? Physical health, treatment for a disease, cure, hopefully. But healing and health can be much broader than that. There are people's emotional health, spiritual health, that all plays a role as far as physical health. And I think it's pretty clear that when we're stressed out, we're more likely to get sick. So individuals that are under constant stress, individuals in war-torn countries or in refugee conditions, even individuals living in poverty that's not related to war, that type of constant stress makes those individuals more susceptible to becoming sick. So how do we support people in that respect as well? This document says, as far as healing is concerned, when we limit illness to disease and healthcare to cure, we miss the deeper dimensions of healing through restoration to God. So community is pretty important in people's emotional health. If you feel like you have people that are supporting you, either family, friends, your church, your neighbors, having a community that supports you can be extremely helpful to your emotional health, and thereby can affect your physical health. There's a study that's cited in one of the books that I've been drawing on a lot for my sessions, which is called Adam, Eve, and the Genome, the Human Genome Project and Theology. It's edited by Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, who teaches, who is president of Chicago Theological Seminary. She's a theologian and social ethicist, and she and a number of other professors at Chicago Theological Seminary ran this course about genetics and health care and other theological issues, and then they compiled it into a book. But one of the studies they cite in this book is a study from the Tuskegee Institute, or a report that was given at a forum held at the Tuskegee Institute, looking at hypertension in African Americans, or people of African descent. And this study found that the further people of African descent lived from Africa, the higher the levels of hypertension that were found within the population. So that would argue against it being a genetic predisposition of people from African descent, but related to how far they lived from Africa. And they interpreted this to mean that the further you live from Africa, the more likely you are to be in a culture where there might be racism, and that could be stressful for people. And it would be that stress that would be more likely to be the cause of the hypertension than a genetic factor. You know, there may be a lot of other things involved, but Africans living in Africa had a far lower percentage affected by hypertension than they also looked at Barbados and.
Did they compare urban and urban and?
No, they didn't. So that would be another thing that you would ask. People living more out in the country versus people living in urban centers. Mm-hmm. That would be an interesting thing to look at, because the stress levels might change depending on where you live. Justice a lot, and that justice also requires a fair distribution of the benefits and burdens of health care. This does not entail treating every person identically, but treating similar cases similarly. Currently, despite programs to provide at least some care for the poorest among us, the percentage of people with health insurance is lower as income declines, which is what we've been discussing. So how do we, moving towards just access to health care, is something that the ELCA considers a priority. The biblical obligation that each person in society is responsible for the neighbor. No one of us is free to pass by on the other side, as in Luke 10:31, and assume that governments and other parties will take care of all obligations for health care. We therefore seek to participate in and supplement health care services out of love for people who are in need. And then the ethical guidance for individuals and families is at the end of the document, and there are a number of things that they list. Five different things: health and finitude, love, stewardship, justice, and self-determination. So under health and finitude, they state, finding ethical guidance begins with being mindful of how we as a people of faith understand health and healthcare and what it means to be healthy. We must accept the limits imposed by human finitude and have realistic expectations of healthcare because our resources also are finite. Health eventually fails, suffering and death come to us all. The promise of the resurrection means that suffering and death are not the final word for our lives.
What is the term finitude?
That means that your life is finite. I think that's what they're referring to, that none of us are going to live forever. And certainly in the healthcare community and in our society at large, we really tend to value life and not letting it end, you know, and going through every possible avenue to try and prolong it. Whereas in some cases, that's not necessarily contributing to the quality of life of that person whose life is being prolonged.
Do you know the statistics of what percentage of healthcare dollars are spent within the last 6 months of life? It's something like 90%, 90%.
But I would presume that it would be large, yeah. So, right, as we get older and more prone to getting sick in some cases, and very near the end of life, yeah, then it's sort of like all the stops are pulled out. Every treatment is tried, the respirator, all those kind of things, and in some cases that may be appropriate, but in many cases perhaps it's not even what's in the best interest of the patient. And often at that point, the patient cannot advocate for themselves, and if they don't have some kind of living will that states what they want or don't want, then they're kind of at a disadvantage. So the second ethical guideline, love, it says people ought to always to act out of love as exemplified by the life of Jesus Christ. Love means giving of ourselves for the sake of others' well-being, doing no harm, promoting the well-being of the neighbor, and treating people with respect and dignity as children of God and as whole persons. And the third thing is stewardship. The obligation to be good stewards of what God has given us should inform our use of healthcare resources. This means using health and healthcare wisely, judiciously, and in service toward God and God's purposes. Congregations are one place to which individuals and families can look for support and guidance in considering these decisions. And I think stewardship could also be looked upon as stewardship of what God has given us in our own body, looking after our own body and taking care of it, being a good steward of our own physical well-being, so trying to make sure we get exercise and that we eat right and that we try not to do things that are going to be detrimental to us. Justice is the fourth. In addition, people should consider their individual healthcare decisions within the context of the just distribution of healthcare resources. Healthcare and its technological instruments increasingly are powerful and expensive. People should ask not only whether they are being served as individuals, but also whether anyone is being left behind in the ongoing advance of medical progress. So that's a pretty difficult one. If someone we love is grievously ill, and there are high-tech things that can be done to save them, you're going to want to do that. Yeah, but this says that perhaps we should think about how that uses healthcare resources and whether people are being left behind. The fifth thing is self-determination. A dominant principle in healthcare ethics is the right of individuals to be freely self-determining with regard to their own bodies and medical treatment decisions. This principle rightly protects against unjustifiable medical and familial paternalism. This church supports an individual's freedom to make healthcare decisions according to her or his own conscience and moral discernment. Yet ultimately, people belong to God, and the exercise of self-determination should always be understood within that relationship. So, that's kind of a complicated statement, I think, and a little hard to understand, but for myself as well. But it sounds like, you know, if somebody's saying, I don't want to do that treatment, even if they're one of our loved ones, we need to respect their decision. You know, like, I've had enough treatments, I'm tired of people sticking needles in me. I'm fine with, you know, but if this is going to be the end, I'm fine with that. It's hard to say okay to that if you love that person. Everybody has a right to make their own decisions about their own bodies and medical treatment. So those are some guidelines from the ELCA. Thinking about supporting, you know, healthcare reform and things like that, that's something that we can all be involved in if we choose. Advocacy, writing to our elected officials if they're involved in healthcare reform that we agree with or don't agree with. It takes a lot of people to change policies like that, but we do have some power to try and effect change, and then how we use our own resources to try and support people in developing countries or people with lesser means in our own communities. Even supporting people that you know are sick, friends, people in your own congregations, supporting them emotionally, that can be a huge, a very healing thing that I think a lot of times we may not think about. Or if someone's dealing with something really difficult, sometimes you just don't know what to say, right? So sometimes you don't say anything to that person, or you don't talk to them as much because you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's so hard to relate. I have a friend whose husband has recently been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's, and don't know much about that disease, and she has a person coming in to be with him, so there's sometimes we can go to lunch or do things. It's just really hard to be with her, you know, because I suppose I should know more about the disease. That would maybe help. But those things are, and yet, what you were saying before about having a community and belonging to somebody who cares about what she's going through. Is important, I'm sure. And not having, maybe some of us don't have a lot of, I have no knowledge or skills in taking care of people, you know, so it's not like, you know, as many of us can do that, so you just have to support people in other ways, like financially.
Right, or even just listening to someone. I mean, it can be really difficult to hear someone laying out all the things that, you know, all the medical problems, all the things that they're frightened about, but just being a pair of ears and saying, yeah, you know, just crying with someone if they're really grieving, it's uncomfortable a lot of times. And, you know, it's something that I'm not great at that either, but just trying to pay attention to who you know who's, you know, going through a health type of crisis and trying to support them. It's something that we can all do on a local level.
I know that a lot of churches have prayer shawls, you know, women who knit prayer shawls, and my mother was on the receiving end of one of those, and it meant so much to her.
Right, it means people are thinking about you, they're praying for you, and then they have some knowledge that you're going through a difficult time.
Right.
And so for spiritual and emotional health.
But and bringing meals, bringing food is always.
Right, and it doesn't necessarily affect a cure.
No.
but it can improve.
It's a way of being there.
The emotional health of the person, and that can have a good effect on their physical health in some cases as well. I think the tougher question for me, well, I mean, that's a tough question too, but another tough question is the whole global health issue. You know, I work for a corporation that, has a good goal, trying to come up with treatments for people with grievous illnesses, cancer, inflammatory diseases, autoimmune disease. I mean, that's a good thing. But a lot of those treatments, you know, it takes so much research and then production money and all that kind of stuff that those treatments are then very costly.
You do research with them, right?
Yeah, basically.
Tell us about that. What research applies directly to getting shipped over them?
Well, I'm not sure any of the research that I do would apply directly to being used in another country because it requires so much technology, so much advanced technology. You know, the question that I ask myself is more like, should I have gone into public health? Would that have been a better use of my skills in biology if I'd gone into public health? And I don't know the answer to that. Or, pharmaceutical companies need to be kind of reorganized. You know, clearly a lot of money gets put into research and development of these treatments. But is there price gouging? Is there too much money being spent on advertising? You know, a lot of other countries, it's against the law to advertise drugs.
How recently has that happened? I mean, it's just within the last
decade or so that you see all the commercials on television say, ask your doctor about the purple pill or whatever. Really putting it in front of people, what's available, and encouraging them to ask their doctors. And on one hand, you want people to be informed about what's out there that might be of benefit to them. But a lot of other countries don't allow that to happen.
And full page ads in like Time and like you know magazine, they're just
Well, they're usually two page ads because one page is the ad and the other page is all the fine print that they're required by law, all the disclaimers and those kind of things that they're required by law to put in that nobody ever reads because the print's not tiny.
I think we've become a society where the pill, a pill, is going to fix whatever it is that's wrong with us.
Well, that seems easier than the lifestyle change, perhaps.
Exactly.
You know, where you have to think about what you're making for dinner and whether it's nutritionally sound or making sure that you work out or get some kind of exercise.
Now, I don't want to tell this story to say that I thought it was not a good thing, but I just want to use it as an example. I have been taking the purple pill for 4 years, and I said to my doctor, okay, because I have hiatal hernia, and I said, okay, what's the long-term effect? What will be the long-term effects? Well, we really don't know because it hasn't been around very long. And then last summer, my mother was ill, and she had something called C. diff, which is a infection of the colon that you get when the bad bacteria, the good bacteria gets killed as well as the bad. It's something you don't want. I mean, it's just horrible. And I saw a few articles this spring about, or late winter, about the increase in the number of cases of C. diff, and that they are questioning whether or not this is related to the number of people that are taking medications like Nexium. And so I thought, whoa, yeah, I don't want that, I'm on this. So I went online and found a diet for GERD. Now, when I went to the doctor, I was just, you know, yes, you will do the test, you've got the hiatal hernia, here's the pill. And there's a diet that, you know, the things that you can eat and that you can't eat, and then small portions, you know, are the key. I'm off the pill. I mean, that's, and I think that we need more information about ways that we can do these things without medication.
Yeah, I have a friend who had a similar experience. She started feeling a lot of intestinal distress, very severe intestinal distress, and went to her doctor. And this is not, you know, I don't want to knock.
No, and I don't either.
Medicine, because they do a lot of great things. But so they prescribed her an antispasmodic for the muscles of, to relax the muscles of her gut. And that just made her feel awful. It just wasn't helping. And so she stopped taking it. And she went to a naturopath who looked at whether she was allergic to anything and did the thing where they take you off almost everything and you're eating rice and a couple of other things for a number of weeks, and then they gradually introduce, and she turned out to be lactose intolerant and also allergic to soy. And since she was a vegetarian, she was eating a lot of soy, and she ramped up the dairy to try and keep the protein levels, and so maybe she'd been lactose intolerant all her life but hadn't eaten that much dairy in the past. And when she took those things out of her diet, she felt fine. So you're right, there needs to be a balance of...
Does your research advise your company on that kind of... I'm interested in what kind of research you do. Because somebody needs to do the research to find out the difference between a pill and a food.
Right. The kind of research I do, I'm in the oncology department. So I do really basic research. Like, my research is at the very beginning of trying to develop drugs. So the pipeline metaphor gets used for drug development, where you start looking at genes over here and what proteins they encode and what they do, and then you find something that might be interesting that you think might be able to be used to treat a condition, or you discover how cells talk to each other and how that's involved in inflammation and try and think of ways to block that or beef it up depending on what condition you're going after. And then it moves through the pipeline, finally into clinical trials. Well, I'm at the very, very beginning. So my research currently...
It's still cancer.
Yeah, my research currently is looking at some genes that when they're dysregulated, they predispose to cancer. So tumor suppressor genes. So it's very, very basic. How do they work? What things regulate? Because one gene can be really important, or the protein product that it encodes. But then that protein may be regulated by a lot of other proteins, so there are these complicated networks, and if they go wrong, then you can have problems. So that's the level of the type of research that I do. It's very, very basic, and you know, the hope is that some of the things that I and others in my group discover and publish may lead to ways to treat early, or to understand more about what's going wrong, and hopefully find places in the network where things could be, where you could develop something that would block that problem or treat the problem in some way.
I guess that's why I asked that. It's almost like it's the wrong paradigm. That is, I'm going to study this stuff and I'm going to find a pill, as opposed to I'm going to study this and see all the different directions it could go. I mean, with two examples we have of not taking pills and just changing a diet, are drug companies just, that doesn't even cross their mind?
Well, no, because they're for profit.
Right, that's my question.
If people change their diet, it doesn't do much for the drug company. People buy a whole bunch of their pill, that brings them lots of money.
You guys know how much, I don't know how common it is among people, more so among women, but let's get gross here for a second. I had hemorrhoids so bad that I'd have to go home and sit in the bathtub in the middle of the day. I'd leave work because I couldn't stand the pain, spending about, I'd say, $20 of every 2 weeks on different kind of medicines, suppositories and stuff. And I started eating Bran, $4 for a box, that lasts a month. It's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
But no doctor told me that. Nobody said, that's what I mean by a paradigm. We're fixed on a way to solve things, and the simple stuff doesn't even cross our mind.
Well, and that's one area where trying to...
I don't spread it on my cereal, it is my cereal. It's Kellogg's All Brand.
All Brand.
That's one area where if we improved our diets or thought more deeply about what we need to have truly good nutrition, that can help us in a lot of ways.
Well, don't women who have, in childbirth, often create hemorrhoids?
Yes.
I remember my wife going through that and all kinds of pains and... Whoops, a little bit of $4 Kellogg's.
I don't know if it's the physicians. I think it, trying to remember if I heard someone say this, but something like basically, well, I'll just go ahead and smoke, they'll figure out a cure for it.
Yeah.
But you know, there's also a presumption of, there'll be a pill when it's when I need it.
Yeah.
So I'm not gonna worry about the lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
And obviously we come to a different passion around that when we're affected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
no, but I think that's true. Yeah. I mean, the good news
these
days with the internet is that you can really search quite quickly and easily, and a lot of times the information is out there, and it's a lot easier to find nowadays. You know, there are a lot of nutrition newsletters, and
right,
but a lot of times when you log into their
sites, the ones who have money,
right? Yep. Good point.
Yeah.
Access to technology is also distributed
among socioeconomic lives. And I don't know what kind of doctor, whether you call this conservative or liberal or whatever, but just to say, what can I do before we go on to medicine or...
Right, is there any indication that there's some other
kind of...
Can
I change habits or food or whatever?
Yeah, lifestyle change that I can do that can help me. And there are probably a lot of physicians that do think about those things. The tendency when you walk into the doctor and say you have some kind of problem is, you know, they know what drugs are on the market to treat that disease. And pharmaceutical companies have reps that go out and see the doctors.
And give them free.
Kellogg's all kind of does it. I'm saying that's not quite as facetious as it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a capitalist country, right? And pharmaceutical companies are for-profit corporations. So they want to... You know, not to say that they don't have good intentions. I think most of them do. I mean, they want to treat grievous illness, but they want to make money also. Which, you know, there's another issue. If you come up with a treatment for something that not really people suffer from, does that get dropped by the company, or do they pursue it? If the market's small, they're more likely to not pursue it. There is something called the orphan drug program, which encourages companies to go ahead and develop some of these things. But in general, you know, you go, we've got this potential drug that's going to hit a patient population of, you know, 2 million, and we have this potential drug that's going to hit a patient population of 10,000.
Yeah, which one gets it?
The economic bottom line dictates. They have this book at the bookstore. I was in there. I don't know who requested it. It wasn't me. The Truth About Drug Companies. So I bought it, and I'm reading it. And you know, I'm not. It's probably going to depress me.
I do know who recommended that, and it's interesting. He's a medical doctor.
Uh huh. Well, and it's written by the woman who used to be the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. For two decades, she was at the New England Journal of Medicine, so she saw changes in how research is supported and how drug companies work. And she doesn't, I've only read a couple chapters, but it seems like her message isn't like they're all bad, but that there needs to be some reform.
You don't know very much. I mean,
patenting is a huge issue in companies. When your patents get run out, that's a huge thing. And so if you can come up with a slightly different version of your drug that really still does about the same thing, then you can get patent on that. And then recommend to physicians that they begin to prescribe that drug, which is on patent, so that generics, you know, that drug companies fear generics because it takes out of their bottom line. And they do put a lot of money into drug development, that much is true. But at least what the author of this book, what her thesis is that there's a lot of price gouging, and why do drugs cost less in Canada, the exact same drugs, than they do in the US?
My parents go to Yuma, Arizona, and you go across the border.
Yeah, well, she mentions that there are trips up to Canada, you know, technically it's illegal. But
they're the same
loads
package,
of people.
The same
yeah, it's the exact
package.
Same thing, right? So what's up with that? That's a little.
This month's time, or this week's time, has a big thing on medicine in India. Hip replacement in the United States, $60,000. India, $5,000. And people are. It's this week's time. It's an incredible comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it costs you $20,000 to get to India. Right.
You know how much of it has to do with insurance providers as well. Reform there would perhaps be helpful.
Yeah. Or you can pay for a vacation to Prague if you're not working.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even two times over. So the argument that the American community, medical community, uses a lot is issue of quality. And
right.
Sometimes that argument is valid. There's some really sloppy medicine overseas, and there's a little bit of it here, but I don't think there's as
less
much.
Less regulation.
Yeah, but it's not always true. There's also
there's good stuff
medicine overseas too. Yeah. So it probably there's more burden you put on the meds or the healthcare consumer when you reach beyond our borders. You take more risk, and you have more responsibility yourself to do your homework. And, firms.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not willing to do that, you probably will safer stay here and pay a higher price.
Well, and here as well, as we've sort of discussed, doing your homework is an important thing. You know, looking into things you can do with your diet that can affect the cure and get you off medicine that you didn't really need to be taking if you were doing other things.
It seems like churches could have a role in their own communities trying to get people to eat more healthy. But then I picture a revolt, like if they change happy hour to not have rules anymore.
Yeah.
People might not go along with it.
That's just whole wheat bun.
But some people have cheese and crackers and fruit or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, the trash can fridge with setting, that's something that our
community
has.
Yeah,
things that too. That support people in the try to get them a living wage in their countries, whichever countries they're in. You know. Also, starting a church garden can be something that gets people into gardening more and thinking more about eating vegetables and things that you grow.
Or finding local food sources.
Right, yeah. That's something that our church has been talking about on and off for the last several years.
Finding local food sources. Like, I live in a rural area, or my parents do too, and there's lots of farmers around, and you know, you can get the direct connections to the people who grow your food, and then it's fresh and local, and you're supporting
I need some of those people to come and talk at adult Sunday school or adult forum. We had somebody from east of the mountains, from somewhere over here, from his farm is called Thundering Hooves, and he used to farm in the traditional methods using a lot of chemicals, and he described his sort of conversion experience when he decided that he needed to start farming organically. And so now his farm is a completely organic farm.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a field trip up to the Skagit Valley to see the farms up there.
Or maybe even forming a walking group or something, church members.
Sure.
Besides doing Bible studies, you can have
right, there's a
walk to whatever.
We don't just have to have potlucks with casseroles in general, right? The mark of a Lutheran, right? The jello salads and the casseroles, and they're very good, but there are a lot of other ways you can have fellowship and community and do something really good for yourself.